This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see. Take monthly automobile sales, add a little bit of telecommunications policy, stir in some water, and a brief history of race on network television. And yeah, I think we got a broadcast. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 4th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You know, every now and then, in one's perusal of the daily headlines, there is an item that makes you go, wait, what? Today was such a day, courtesy of General Motors. The once troubled but now doing quite a bit better, thank you very much, car company reported profits this morning that were 91% higher than the same quarter a year ago. All in all, it's a good time to be making and selling cars and trucks in this country. Sales are up. Gas is cheap. Kind of an interesting comeback from a tough 2014 and before. Marketplace's Adam Ellington gets us going.
The news from Detroit can be confusing. You'll hear about recalls, sales increases, profit forecasts, and all kinds of whiz-bang new cars. But let me just give you the gist. The U.S. auto market is surging. For the past few years, nearly every car maker selling in the U.S. has seen good things happen to its bottom line. And yes, part of the reason for this goes back to the recession.
The recession allowed the Detroit makers to catch up in a lot of critical ways to their import competition, particularly the Japanese.
Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of TheDetroitBureau.com.
They were able to shed a lot of debt. They were able to drive down costs, labor costs in particular. They squeezed their suppliers. They got rid of unnecessary plants.
Pent-up demand from buyers also came online precisely at the moment many automakers rolled out a bevy of refreshed models, particularly in the high-profit SUV and light truck markets.
They have product in the market that they don't have to incentivize people to buy.
Kristen Dietrich is a director with the Center for Automotive Research. Carmakers aren't slashing sticker prices like they used to, but Dietrich says pressure to keep manufacturing costs low couldn't be higher. Per car costs are much lower now thanks to wage and benefit concessions by the UAW, but the Detroit Three will negotiate new four-year contracts later this year, and this time labor wants a bigger share.
Workers are going to be looking for base wage increases and more money, and companies are going to be looking for cost containment, cost restraint.
Wage concessions have been key to a hiring surge at Ford. The company just announced today plans to add another 1,500 entry-level workers to keep ahead of demand for its new F-150 trucks. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Consolidation, thy name is Office Supplies. There was confirmation this morning that Staples has agreed to buy Office Depot for $6.3 billion, a deal that comes just 2 years after Office Depot absorbed Office Max. It is, this original one, an acquisition that's been a long time in coming. The first time that Office Depot and Staples tried and failed to tie the corporate knot was back in 1996. Stan Alcorn brings us a history lesson.
When Staples last tried to buy Office Depot, the number one song in America was the Macarena. And these two companies dominated a growing market for reams of paper and hanging files.
If they thought that their counterpart was going to lower prices, then they'd lower prices. If they thought that their counterpart was going to raise prices, they'd raise prices.
Antitrust lawyer Michael Keeley says that is why the Federal Trade Commission halted the deal. It found a merger of the two companies would be able to raise prices unchecked.
Only Office Max, the other superstore back then, was in the same space acting in the same way.
But in the last 20 years, two things changed, according to Professor Robert Solomon at the Stern School.
The first is the rise of the big box store, stores like Walmart and Target. And the second thing that changed is technology.
Today, people can and do buy office supplies on Walmart and Target's websites, not to mention online retail giant Amazon.
And that's a very, very tough place to compete.
IHS analyst Chris Christopher expects sales at office supply and stationery retailers to drop by 7% this year. That's more than $1 billion.
There's nothing in their favor for the most part.
I'm sure that's what they'll be telling the FTC.
Michael Keeley, the antitrust lawyer, says this logic, that it's about survival, not price fixing, worked 2 years ago when the FTC let Office Depot take over Office Max. This time,
I think what the FTC will do here is say, let's make sure we were right.
He expects the FTC to double check that prices haven't spiked since then, when three office supply stores became two, before it lets the remaining two become one. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Before I get to the markets, today's investment phrase of the day is dead cat bounce. Oil by name. You might have noticed crude was up a whopping 20% from Thursday to yesterday. Yeah, up no more. Oil tumbled 9% today, back down under $50 a barrel. In equities, a little bit of a mixed bag, actually. Two indices down, one up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, made it official today. He wants internet service providers to be regulated under Title II of the Communications Act of 1934, or in non-bureaucraties, more like phone companies than they are right now, which would mean, to paraphrase Mr. Wheeler, no internet fast lanes and no internet slow lanes. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He's here to discuss just a tad. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so we did some of this on the program yesterday, right? Nancy Marshall-Genzer told us what would happen from a legal standpoint, I guess, if the FCC votes the way the chairman wants them to. What happens for me, the regular consumer sitting on my couch?
Well, nothing so far.
And
that's
right,
kind of the
by.
Idea,
Thank
Kai.
You.
That's kind of the idea, right? Is the FCC wants to use Title II in this case or regulate free and open internet mm-hmm. with these new rules so that nothing changes for you as the consumer sitting on your couch surfing the internet watching cat videos. They want everyone to be able to reach you with equal speed, which is basically what happens now, and they want it to stay that way. Mm-hmm. And right now, there's no enforcer for that, and the FCC wants to be that enforcer.
And so that's what all the hubbub is about.
That's what all the hubbub is about. And I talked to Susan Crawford. She's co-director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Here's what she said.
Okay.
The country and the president is taking seriously the notion that we need industrial policy, you know, a big nationwide approach to high-speed internet access. And that's like what's happened in Sweden and in Norway and Hong Kong and Japan and South Korea.
It's a great line, industrial policy, right?
Yeah, industrial big policy,
right.
Which is big government, right, as
right.
far as some people are concerned. But I should also mention all those countries she just listed off there, Kai, they all score better than us when it comes to speed and access. And America invented the internet. I mean,
yes,
America and Al Gore, right? You know,
right.
They invented
that's
the
right.
internet. So the FCC and the president is saying, look, we really need to be at the forefront of speed and access around the world. And Title II, you know, basically regulating internet service providers, and I should also say wireless providers, as public utilities is the way to do that.
All right, quickly, what happens now? The FCC is obviously going to vote, and then what?
Well, all the net neutrality advocates, you know, are throwing a party at this moment, but it may
right.
not last very long, Kai, because we've already got a bill moving through Congress. It's a Republican-supported bill, and it has some of the same provisions that Title II would do, but it also wants to take away this sort of enforcer role from the FCC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the president will likely veto that kind of bill, and so then we look to the courts. And, Kai, AT&T, Verizon, all of these internet service providers and wireless carriers are already lining up to say, guess what? We're going at you in the courts, and we're going to see some long, protracted court battles going forward, Kai. It's not over.
The end, perhaps, of the beginning. Ben Johnson from Marketplace Tech. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Kai.
Yesterday, Sarah Gardner took us to her hometown, Waukesha, Wisconsin, to kick off the series that we are doing this month called Water, The High Price of Cheap. Waukesha is a former spa town that was once famous for its spring water, but which now has a big water problem, deep wells that are tainted with radium. So the city is looking to ditch its underground wells and get its drinking water elsewhere, Lake Michigan, to be just a little bit more precise. But as Sarah tells us, Waukesha's plans aren't going to be easy or cheap to get done.
Growing up in Waukesha, I drank the water without ever wondering where it came from. Now I know.
This is a deep aquifer well.
Dan Dukniak is general manager of the Waukesha Water Utility. We're in a small brick building that I've driven past dozens of times but never noticed. It houses one of 11 wells in the city that supplies drinking water.
This well goes down about 2,200 feet, and then we pump water up from that aquifer, and this water then goes through the pipes, through the green.
The radium levels in Waukesha's deep well water are over three times the federal limit. Radium's naturally occurring, but lifetime exposure is a cancer risk. And the deeper you go in the sandstone aquifer under this region, the more radium there is. Waukesha is under a consent order to fix the problem. It has taken temporary steps, but the city is seeking a long-term solution. And that solution, says Dukniak, is building a pipeline to tap Lake Michigan.
Really, it's a no-brainer of a decision. The Great Lakes is the best, most reliable, and only reasonable alternative for the city of Waukesha.
Certainly, it would be the simplest solution, except, that is, for the Great Lakes Compact. The compact bans sizable diversions from the lakes, with a few exceptions. Lawmakers passed it in part out of fear that drought-prone cities in the Southwest might someday make a play for Great Lakes water. Peter McAvoy is an attorney with a Great Lakes watchdog group.
We have had some unbelievable public policy and big programs designed to move water great distances. And now we're starting to see there are problems with that.
Waukesha is the first city outside the Great Lakes Basin asking for water from one of the five Great Lakes, so it will set a precedent. And under the compact, the city has to prove it can't find a reasonable alternative to Lake Michigan in its own backyard. And it has to prove that to all eight Great Lakes states, from Minnesota to New York. Eric Ebersberger is with the Wisconsin agency reviewing Waukesha's request.
The administration here has been very clear that this should be very difficult. It should be difficult to prove up an application for a diversion.
Ebersberger figures the water Waukesha is asking for amounts to less than 0.001% of the total water in Lake Michigan, and the city has to treat and return most of it. But its plans have raised debate about what it means to live within your water supply and just how much growth a water beggar should be allowed. Peter McAvoy.
Their own studies show that they're talking about industrial and business growth. Well, now, is that reasonable? Is that going to come at the expense of other communities within the Great Lakes Basin?
That question may resonate loudest in nearby Milwaukee, one of the country's poorest cities, Peter Annan.
The citizens of Milwaukee say, if you want to use Lake Michigan water, move to our great city and use it. We don't want to see it leaving town and contributing to sprawl out in the suburbs.
Waukesha is asking for more water than it currently uses, partly because the state wants it to plan for neighboring areas that might need to connect to city water someday. And city officials don't want to underestimate future water needs, especially when the economy is still in recovery. Mayor Sean Riley says the city may grow some, but he expects more water conservation, too.
It's very, very difficult to just remain stagnant. Municipalities are actually organisms. And to not have any change usually doesn't turn out very well.
If Waukesha loses its bid for Lake Michigan water, it'll have to come up with more local alternatives. Alternatives it's already concluded are either too short-term, environmentally inferior, or too expensive. But whatever the city ends up doing to replace its contaminated well water, the solution will be expensive. 87-year-old Paul Vrakas was mayor when I lived in Waukesha. He says back then, city leaders thought water was a bottomless pit. In his retirement, he says, he's been reflecting on that.
We've lived in our country with these important things that we need in our lives being very cheap. Well, we're going to have to spend more money on that important stuff than we are on extra pair of jeans Do you know what I'm saying?
The citizens of Waukesha certainly do. Dan Dukniak has warned them to expect their water bills to double and possibly triple. In Waukesha, Wisconsin, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on our series, Water, the High Price of Cheap, Marketplace's Scott Tong on his family's water footprint. Also, we want to know how you use water every day. Take a picture, use the hashtag waterlog, L-O-G, stick it on Instagram, and we'll have a look. The one with the most likes, by the way, gets a Marketplace water bottle. Maybe we could arrange to have it autographed for you or something. I don't know. Coming up.
I think our show, even if it's not perfect, is important to the Asian community.
ABC's new sitcom, Fresh Off the Boat, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials was up 6 points today. That's less than a 0.1%. Closed at 17,673, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 11 points, 0.25%. Ended things at 4716. The S&P 500 dipped 8 points, 0.4%. Finished things at 2,041. Cable and broadband providers advanced after FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler did what we told you he did. Comcast beamed up 2.3% today. Time Warner Cable ticked up 2%. Charter Communications swung up 3.3%. Mixed day for some iconic American brands. Disney swooshed up 7.3%. That's Disney, not Nike, by the way. Late yesterday, it announced better-than-expected quarterly profits and revenue figures. Upscale clothes retailer Ralph Lauren cast off 18.25%, reported a drop in quarterly earnings and said revenue was flat as the strong dollar hit overseas sales. Office Depot drove up 2.2%. Staples clipped down 12%. Bond prices, yield on the 10-year T-note, fell to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Barack Obama and the First Lady will attend the annual National Prayer Breakfast. The Labor Department reports on weekly jobless claims. And everyone, go grab a spoon. It's World Nutella Day. Put that chocolatey hazelnut spread on everything, guilt-free. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just because this is the way capitalism works sometimes, a cautionary tale now from the healthcare industry. Gilead Sciences, that's a biopharma company out of California, released a really spiffy earnings report yesterday. Revenues more than doubled, profits beat expectations, just what you want to see. But the company also warned that profits from two of its newest and very expensive blockbuster drugs are going to be fading. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains why.
Make no mistake, the colorful pills that go under the names Harvoni and Sovaldi, Gilead's new hepatitis C drugs, are very good at treating the devastating liver disease.
We finally have what we would consider the holy grail of medicine, drugs which can treat a very complex chronic condition and bring it to near curative state.
Physician Kavita Patel treats patients with hepatitis C. She also researches drug pricing at the Brookings Institution. She says these new drugs, very costly to research and test, have an astronomical list price, except
what is advertised as, quote, the sticker price, when I just said $80,000 to $130,000, that's not what anybody really pays if you have private health insurance.
That's because health insurers and pharmacy benefit managers negotiate deep discounts to get these drugs for their patients. Gilead surprised investors this week by saying those discounts are reaching 45% and more than 50% for Medicaid and the Veterans Administration. So who's losing here? Healthcare economist Gail Walensky has an idea. She ran Medicare and Medicaid in the George H.W. Bush administration.
It may well be that the main people who take the haircut, the difference between the list price and what's negotiated, are the owners of Gilead, that is, the shareholders.
Now, Walensky says don't weep for Gilead. After all, it's been charging an arm and a leg for these drugs until now. And it had to anticipate that competitors would bring out their own drugs for hepatitis C and that they'd offer big discounts to undercut Gilead's pricing, which they are doing. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
ABC's got a new show premiering tonight that is, by most accounts, pretty typical network fare. A half-hour sitcom about a family set in Orlando, Florida. Catch is that the family is Asian American, the first network show centered around an Asian American family in 20 years. It's called Fresh Off the Boat, based on Chef Eddie Huang's memoir of the same name. Constance Wu plays 11-year-old Eddie's mother, Jessica. Constance, thanks so much for coming in.
Good to be here.
This is it. This is the big break, as they say, for you.
Is that what they're saying?
You don't think so? That's kind of the buzz.
Well, then, okay. I mean, it's strange to hear that kind of a thing because, you know, I've been sort of working regional theater and like little stuff for years. But
here you are now on a big fancy network show. And more to the point, a network show about Asian Americans, the likes of which we have not seen in this country in 20 years. Am I being unreasonable if I say there's a lot riding on this?
I think there are for a lot of Asian Americans in terms of representation in the media. It's been fascinating for me watching the response.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, for example, there was a piece that Eddie Huang wrote a couple weeks ago.
The guy on whose life and book this series is based.
Yeah.
Loosely, we should say.
Yeah. And he wrote this piece all about, you know, how the network sort of watered down his voice. But in the end, he sort of understood that he had to sort of lose this battle to win the greater war of representation, and that something, it's not going to be perfect the first go.
Well, especially, I mean, this piece that was in Vulture, and we'll have a link on our website so you can go read it, because it actually was really interesting. In the end, when you get to the end of it, and it's a long one, he reconciles with the show.
Yeah.
And he reconciles over this moment where the character of Eddie Huang as a young boy is in the school cafeteria, and this kid says to him, "Get to the back of the line, chink." That was a moment for me where I went, "Oh my God, they said that." That's where the punctuation mark on this show comes.
Yeah, the fact that they were willing to address that word on network television.
Right.
There are plenty of other things that, you know, they weren't not ready to address yet, if you read the book.
Yeah.
But that was a big thing for him. And so for him to win that battle was very important, I think.
Yeah.
The best we can do is at least open the discussion up and not pretend like everything's peachy, because it's not, and that's how you progress.
What's it like for you as an Asian American actor when you go into an audition and you're the only Asian face there?
It's very rare that I'm the only Asian face. Usually, I'll be auditioning for the third lead, and there will be Latina actresses, Indian actresses, African-American actresses, because it's like, let's check off this box. Like, we have our lead white girl, and we need an ethnic slot. And I've actually been told, oh, we decided that the guy's best friend was going to be Asian, so we needed the girl's best friend to be black because we couldn't have two Asians.
Wow.
Like,
that's crazy.
Yeah, because they want to check off their boxes, which in its own way is like a kind of perverted gesture of like trying.
Are you okay with this show being seen as a first step, really, in the viable business of putting Asian Americans on television, right? Because ABC is investing a boat full of money in this show. They, you know, it's not cheap, any of this stuff.
Not only am I okay with it, I'm really glad that it's happening, and I think it's long overdue. There's a lot of controversy in the Asian community about the fact that, for example, Scarlett Johansson recently was cast in the lead part in Ghost in the Shell, which is supposed to be an Asian female lead. And people are like, well, there is no Asian actor or actress who can carry that. And I understand from an investor's viewpoint, like, if I want a return on my investment and I have Scarlett Johansson as my lead, I'll probably get a bigger box office success than, like, a no-name
actor.
Yeah,
but how are you going to get there? How are we going to get there as a society if the no-name actors don't get that whack? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think our show, even if it's not perfect, is important to the Asian community. Because if we do make money, it'll hopefully start the ball rolling in terms of finding that Asians can carry a show or a movie and be a box office draw, which will encourage investors to take that risk as well.
Constance Wu. It's a show called Fresh Off the Boat. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We've got a link to that Vulture article I mentioned, as well as clips from Fresh Off the Boat and Margaret Cho's 1994 show, All American Girl. It is all online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which I guess everybody's got their pet peeves, on Medium.com today, an item detailing the 47,000 edits that one man has made to Wikipedia, virtually all of them to remove the phrase comprised of. As in, just for instance, the monthly jobs report is comprised of two surveys. Yeah, no Marketplace angle on that, by the way. No nothing, just kind of fascinating in a grammar person kind of way. We've got a link to it on our homepage if you want to read it. It is, once again, marketplace.org. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 6 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 11 points, a 0.25%. The S&P 500 dipped 8 points, 0.4%. Our engineering staff is comprised of Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.